given to the faith by Lord Tristan's son, Lord Barris, to become the voice of the seven on earth, commanding the swords of the faith militant and the hearts of all the faithful from dawn to the neck. Old Town became their holy city, and many devout men and women travelled there to pray at its septs and shrines and other holy places. Doubtless it was in part due to these ties to the seven that the Hightowers were so often able to keep themselves separate from Harsh Gardener's countless wars. The faith was not the only institution to flourish behind the massive walls of Old Town, under the protection of the Hightower. Thousands of years before the first sept opened its doors, the city had been home to the Citadel, where boys and young men from all over Westeros came to study, learn, and forge their chains as maesters. No greater seat of knowledge exists anywhere in the world. By the time of Aegon's conquest, Old Town was beyond question the greatest city in all of Westeros, the largest, richest, and most populous, and a center of both learning and faith. Even so, it might well have suffered the same fate as Harrenhal, if not for the close ties between the Hightower and the Starry Sept, for it was the High Septon who persuaded Lord Manfred Hightower to offer no resistance to Aegon Targaryen and his dragons, but instead to open his gates at the conqueror's approach and do him homage. The conflict, thus averted, flared up again a generation later, however, during the bloody struggle between the faith and the conqueror's second son, the aptly named King Maegor the Cruel. The High Septon, during the first years of Maegor's reign, was kin by marriage to the Hightowers. His sudden death in 44 AC, shortly after King Maegor had threatened to incinerate the Starry Sept with dragon fire, in his fury over his High Holiness's condemnation of his later marriages, is considered quite fortuitous, as it allowed Lord Martin Hightower to open his gates before Balerion and Vhagar unleash their flames.
The unexpected nature of the High Septon's death in 44 AC aroused much suspicion, however, and whispers of murder persist to this day. Some believe His High Holiness was removed by his own brother, Sir Morgan Hightower, commander of the Warrior's Sons in Old Town, and it is undeniably true that Sir Morgan was the sole Warrior's son pardoned by King Maegor. Others suspect Lord Martin's maiden aunt, the Lady Patrice Hightower, though their argument seems to rest upon the belief that poison is a woman's weapon. It has even been suggested that the Citadel might have played a role in the removal of the High Septon, though this seems far-fetched at best.
Harsh Tyrell. The Tyrells were never kings, though royal blood flows in their veins, as in half a hundred of the other great houses of the Reach. Sir Alastair Tyrell, the founder of the line, was an Andal adventurer who became the champion and sworn shield to King Gawain the Fifth Gardener, one of the three Sage Kings. His elder son became a notable knight as well, only to die in a tourney. The second son, Gareth, was of a more bookish bent and never achieved knighthood, choosing to serve as a royal steward instead. It is from him that today's Tyrells descend. Gareth Tyrell and his son Leo performed their duty so ably that the Gardeners made the office of High Steward hereditary. Through the centuries, many generations of Tyrells served in that capacity. Many became close confidants and advisers to their kings. Some also acted as castellans in times of war. At least one ruled the Reach as regent during the minority of King Garlan VI. King Giles III, Gardener, declared the Tyrells to be my most leal servants, and King Mern VI was so pleased with them that he gave Sir Robert Tyrell the hand of his youngest daughter in marriage, thereby allowing their sons, grandsons, and all the generations to follow to claim descent from Garth Greenhand. That was the first marriage between House Gardener and House Tyrell, that 9 more unions between the two houses followed in the centuries to come. It was not their royal blood that made Aegon Targaryen choose to name the Tyrells as Lords of Highgarden, Wardens of the South, and Lords Paramount of the Reach. After King Mann the Ninth, the last of the Gardener Kings, died, along with all his sons, upon the Field of Fire. Those honours were won by the prudence of Harlan Tyrell, who opened the gates of Highgarden at Aegon's approach, and pledged himself and his family to House Targaryen. Afterwards, a number of the other great houses of the Reach complained bitterly about being made vassals of an upjump steward, and insisted that their own blood was far nobler than that of the Tyrells. It cannot be denied that the Oakharts of Old Oak, the Florence of Brightwater Keep, the Rowans of Golden Grove, the Peaks of Starpike, and the Red Wines of the Arbor all had older and more distinguished lineages than the Tyrells, and closer blood ties to House Gardener as well. Their protests were of no avail, however, mayhaps in part because all these houses had taken up arms against Aegon and his sisters on the Field of Fire, whereas the Tyrells had not. Aegon Targaryen's judgment in this proved sound. Lord Harlan proved a capable steward for the Reach, though he only ruled until 5 AC, when he disappeared with his army in the deserts of Dorne during Aegon's first Dornish War. His son Theo Tyrell was understandably reluctant to become involved in any further attempts to conquer Dorne, but eventually became embroiled when the conflict spilled out beyond the Red Mountains. When the Targaryens at last made peace with Dorne, Lord Theo turned his attention to consolidating Tyrell power by arranging a council of septons and maesters to examine and finally dismiss some of the more persistent of the claims to Highgarden by those who insisted that the seat was theirs. As Lords of Highgarden and Wardens of the South, the descendants of these upjump Stuarts rank amongst the most powerful lords of the realm, and they have been called on to fight beneath the Targaryen banner on many occasions. For most of those occasions, they have come as called, though wisely they played no part in the Dance of the Dragons, as the young Lord Tyrell was at the time a babe in swaddling clothes, and his mother and castellan chose to keep Highgarden out of that dreadful, fratricidal bloodbath. Later, when King Daeryn the First Targaryen, the young dragon, marched on Dorne, the Tyrells proved their valour by leading the main thrust over the Prince's Pass. Having served faithfully, if perhaps too boldly, Lord Lynel Tyrell was given charge of Dorne after the young dragon returned in triumph to King's Landing. His lordship succeeded in keeping the Dornishmen pacified for a time, only to suffer a gruesome death in the infamous Bed of Scorpions. His murder ignited the rising that swept Dorne, eventually bringing about the death of the young dragon at the age of 8 and 10. Of the Tyrells who succeeded the ill-fated Lord Lynel at Highgarden in the years since, the most notable is Lord Leo Tyrell, a tawny champion remembered to this day as Leo Longthorn. Many consider him the finest jouster ever to couch a lance. Lord Leo also won distinction during the first Blackfyre Rebellion, winning notable victories against Daemon Blackfyre's adherents in the Reach. Though his forces were unable to gather quickly enough to arrive in time for the Battle of the Red Grass Field. The present Lord of Highgarden, Mace Tyrell, fought loyally for House Targaryen during Robert's Rebellion, defeating Robert Baratheon himself at the Battle of Ashford, and later besieging his brother Stannis in Storm's End for the better part of a year. With the death of Mad King Aerys II and his son, Prince Rhaegar, however, Lord Mace laid down his sword, and is today once again Warden of the South and a leal servant of King Robert and the Iron Throne. Highgarden. The great castle of Highgarden, the ancient seat of the Tyrell lords and the Gardener kings before them, sits atop a verdant hill overlooking the broad and tranquil waters of the Mandel. Seen from afar, the castle looks so much a part of the land one could think it had grown there rather than being built. Many consider Highgarden to be the most beautiful castle in all the Seven Kingdoms, a claim that only the men of the Vale see fit to dispute. They prefer their own eyrie. The hill from which Highgarden rises is neither steep nor stony, but broad in extent, with gentle slopes and a pleasing symmetry. From the castle walls and towers, a man can see for leagues in all directions, across orchards and meadows and fields of flowers, including the golden roses of the Reach that have long been the sigil of House Tyrell. Highgarden is girded by three concentric rings of crenellated curtain walls, made of finely dressed white stone and protected by towers as slender and graceful as maidens. Each wall is higher and thicker than the one below it. Between the outermost wall that girdles the foot of the hill and the middle wall above it can be found Highgarden's famed Briar Maze, a vast and complicated labyrinth of thorns and hedges maintained for centuries for the pleasure and delight of the castle's occupants and guests, and for defensive purposes, for intruders unfamiliar with the maze cannot easily find their way through its traps and dead ends to the castle gates. Within the castle walls, greenery abounds, and the keeps are surrounded by gardens, arbors, pools, fountains, courtyards, and man-made waterfalls. Ivy covers the older buildings, and grapes and climbing roses snake up the sides of statuary walls and towers. Flowers bloom everywhere. The keep is a palace, like few others, filled with statues, colonnades, and fountains. Highgarden's tallest towers, round and slender, look down upon neighbors far more ancient, square, and grim in appearance, the oldest of them dating from the Age of Heroes. The rest of the castle is of more recent construction, much of it built by King Mern the Sixth after the destruction of the original structures by the Dornish during the reign of Garth Greybeard. The guards, both old and new, are well served in Highgarden. The splendor of the castle sept, with its rows of stained glass windows celebrating the Seven and the ubiquitous Garth Greenhand, is rivaled only by that of the great sept of Baelor in King's Landing and the starry sept of Oldtown. And Highgarden's lush green godswood is almost as renowned, for in the place of a single heart tree it boasts three towering, graceful, ancient weirwoods, whose limbs have grown so entangled over the centuries that they appear to be almost a single tree with three trunks, reaching for each other above a tranquil pool. Legend has it that these trees, known in the Reach as the Three Singers, were planted by Garth Greenhand himself. No seat in the Seven Kingdoms has been more celebrated in song than Highgarden, and small wonder, for the Tyrells and Gardeners before them have made their court a place of culture and music and high art. In the days before the conquest, the kings of the Reach and their queens presided over tourneys of love and beauty, where the greatest knights of the Reach competed for the love of the fairest maidens, not only with feats of arms, but with song, poetry, and demonstrations of virtue, piety, and chaste devotion. The greatest champions, men as pure and honorable and virtuous as they were skilled at arms, were honored with invitations to join the Order of the Green Hand. Though the last members of that noble order perished beside their king on the field of fire, save in White Harbor, where the knights of House Manderley still profess membership, their traditions are still remembered in the Reach, where the Tyrells continue to uphold all that is best in knighthood and chivalry. Their tourney of the Field of Roses in the reign of Jaehaerys I, the Old King, was famed far and wide as the greatest tourney in a generation, and many other great tourneys have been held in the Reach in more recent days. The Stormlands. The storms that blow up the narrow sea are infamous throughout the Seven Kingdoms, and in the Nine Free Cities as well. Though they may arise in any season, seafarers say the worst of them come each autumn, forming in the warm waters of the summer sea south of the Stepstones, then roaring north across those bleak and stony islands. More than half continue north by northwest, according to the archives at the Citadel, sweeping over Cape Wrath and the Rainwood, gathering strength and moisture as they cross the waters of Shipbreaker Bay before slamming into Storm's End on Durand's Point. It is from these great gales that the Stormlands take their name. The heart of this ancient kingdom was Storm's End, the last and greatest of the castles raised by the hero king Durand Godsgreef in the Age of Heroes, which stands immense and immovable atop the towering cliffs of Durand's Point. South, beyond Shipbreaker Bay, with its wild waters and treacherous rocks, lies Cape Wrath. The moist, green tangle of the Rainwood dominates the northern two-thirds of the cape. Farther south, a broad plain opens up, rolling gently down to the Sea of Dawn, where numerous small fishing villages dot the shoreline. A thriving port and market, the Weeping Town, as it came to be known, because it was where the body of the slain hero, King Daeron the First Targaryen, returned to his kingdom after his murder in Dawn, stands here, and much of the region's trade passes through its harbour. The great island of Tarth, with its waterfalls and lakes and soaring mountains, is considered part of the Stormlands as well, as are Estamont and the myriad lesser isles found off Cape Wrath and the Weeping Town. To the west, the hills rise hard and wild, pushing against the sky until they give way to the Red Mountains, the border between the Stormlands and Dawn. Deep, dry valleys and great sandstone cliffs dominate the landscape here, and it is true that sometimes at sunset the peaks gleam scarlet and crimson against the clouds. Yet there are those who say these mountains were named not for the colour of their stone, but for all the blood that is soaked into the ground. Farther inland, beyond the foothills, lie the marches, a vast expanse of grasslands, moors, and windswept plains stretching westward and northward for hundreds of leagues. There in the sight of the Red Mountains the great castles of the Marcher Lord stand, built to guard the borders of the Stormlands against Dornish incursions from the south and the steel-clad minions of the kings of the Reach from the west. The greatest of the Marcher Lords are the Swans of Stonehelm, the Dondarrions of Blackhaven, the Selmys of Harvest Hall, and the Carons of Night Song, whose singing towers marked the westernmost extent of the realm of the Storm Kings. All these remain sworn to Storm's End to this day, as they have been from time immemorial. North of Storm's End, however, the borders of the kingdom have fluctuated greatly over the centuries, as Storm Kings, strong and weak, gained and lost lands in a succession of wars both great and small. Today the writ of House Baratheon runs to the south bank of the Wend Water and lower reaches of the King's Wood, and along the stony shores of the narrow sea up to the base of Massey's Hook. But before Aegon's conquest, before even the coming of the Andals, the warrior kings of House Durrandon pushed their borders considerably farther. Massey's Hook was part of their realm then, and all the Kingswood as far as the Blackwater Rush. In certain epochs, the Storm Kings even ruled beyond the Blackwater. Towns as far-flung as Duskendale and Maidenpool once paid homage to Storm's End, and under the redoubtable warrior, King Arlan III, Durrandon, the Stormlanders took dominion over the entire Riverlands. They held them for more than three centuries. Yet even at their greatest extent, The realms of the Durrandons and their successors have always been thinly peopled, when compared to the Reach, the Riverlands, and the West. And thus the might of the Lords of Storm's End was diminished. Those who do choose to make their homes in the Stormlands, whether along the stony shores of the narrow sea, amidst the dripping green forests of the Rainwood, or on the windswept marches, are a special breed, however. The people of the Stormlands are like unto their weather, it has oft been said, tumultuous, violent, implacable, unpredictable. The Coming of the First Men. The history of the Stormlands stretches back to the Dawn Age. Long before the coming of the First Men, all Westeros belonged to the Elder Races, the Children of the Forest and the Giants, and some say the Others, the terrifying White Walkers of the Long Night. The Children made their homes in the vast primeval forest that once stretched from Cape Wrath to Cape Kraken, north of the Iron Islands. Today all that remains of this great wood are the Kingswood and the Rainwood, and the giants in the foothills of the Red Mountains and along the rugged, stony spine of Massey's Hook. Unlike the later Andals, who came to Westeros by sea, the First Men made their way from Essos across the great land bridge we now call the Broken Arm of Dawn. So Dawn itself and the Stormlands to the north were the first parts of Westeros to know the steps of man. The wet wild of the Rainwood was a favoured haunt of the Children of the Forest, the tales tell us. And there were giants in the hills that rose wild in the shadow of the Red Mountains, and amongst the defiles and ridges of the stony peninsula that came to be called Massey's Hook. Although the giants were a shy folk, and ever hostile to man, it is written that in the beginning, the Children of the Forest welcomed the newcomers to Westeros, in the belief that there was land enough for all. The forest shaped the First Men, who made their homes beneath the ancient oaks, towering redwoods, sentinels, and soldier pines. By the banks of small streams rose rude villages, where folk hunted and trapped as their lords permitted. The Firs and the Stormlands were well regarded, but the true riches of the Rainwood were found in its timber and its rare hardwoods. The harvesting of the trees soon brought the First Men into conflict with the Children of the Forest, however, and for hundreds and thousands of years they made war upon one another, until the First Men took the old gods of the Children for their own and divided up the lands in the pact sealed on the Isle of Faces, amidst the great lake called the God's Eye. The pact came late in the history of man in Westeros, however. By the time it was signed, the giants, who were no part of it, were almost gone from the Stormlands, and even the Children were much diminished. House Durrandon. Much of the early history of Westeros is lost in the mists of time, where it becomes ever more difficult to separate fact from legend, the further back one goes. This is particularly true of the Stormlands, where the First Men were comparatively few, and the Elder Races strong. Elsewhere in the Seven Kingdoms, the runes that tell their stories survive to this day, chiseled into cave walls and standing stones and the ruins of fallen strongholds. But in the Stormlands, oft as not, the First Men carved the tales of their victories and defeats into the trunks of trees long since rotted away. Moreover, a tradition developed amongst the Storm Kings of old for naming the king's firstborn son and heir after Durin Godsgrief, the founder of their line, further compounding the difficulties of the historian. The bewildering number of King Durins has inevitably caused much confusion. The maesters of the Citadel of Oldtown have given numbers to many of these monarchs in order to distinguish one from the other, but that was not the practice of the singers, unreliable at the best of times, who are our chief source for these times. The legends surrounding the founder of House Durrandon, Durin Godsgrief, all come to us through the singers. The songs tell us that Durin won the heart of Elenai, daughter of the sea god and the goddess of the wind. By yielding to a mortal's love, Elenai doomed herself to a mortal's death, and for this the gods, who had given her birth, hated the man she had taken for her lord husband. In their wrath, they sent howling winds and lashing rains to knock down every castle Durin dared to build, until a young boy helped him erect one so strong and cunningly made that he could defy their gales. The boy grew to be Brandon the Builder. Durin became the first Storm King. With Elenai at his side, he lived and reigned at Storm's End for 1,000 years, or so the stories claim. Such a lifespan seems most unlikely, even for a hero married to the daughter of two gods. Archmaester Glaive, himself a Stormlander by birth, once suggested that this king of 1,000 years was in truth a succession of monarchs all bearing the same name, which seems plausible, but must forever remain unproved. Whether he was one man or 50, we know that in this time the kingdom extended its writ far beyond Storm's End and its hinterlands, absorbing neighbouring kingdoms one by one over the centuries. Some were won by treaties, some by marriage, more by conquest, a process that was continued by Durin's descendants. The Godsgrief himself was first to claim the Rainwood, that wet wilderness that had hitherto belonged only to the children of the forest. His song, Durin the Devout, returned to the children most of what his father had seized. But a century later, Durin Bronze Axe took it back again, this time for good and all. The songs tell us that Durin the Dwarf slew Lun the Last, king of the giants, at the Battle of Crookwater. But scholars still debate whether he was Durin the Fifth or Durin the Sixth. Maldon Massey built the castle Stone Dance and established his lordship over Massey's Hook under another King Durin, called the Raven Friend. But his dates and number remain in dispute as well. It was Durin the Young, also known as the Butcher Boy, who dammed the River Slane with Dornish corpses after turning back Yorin Ironwood and the warrior maid Willa of Will in the battle by the Bloody Pool. But was he the same king who became besotted with his own niece in later life and died at the hands of his brother, Eric Kinkiller? These and many similar questions will most likely never be resolved. Somewhat better sources exist for later centuries, however. We can say with fair certainty that the great island kingdom of Tarth fell under the sway of House Durrandon when Durin the Fair took to wife the daughter of its king, Edwin Evenstar. Their grandson, Eric the Sailmaker, most likely Eric the Third, was the first to claim Estamont and the Lesser Isles farther south. It was another Durin, during the Tenth, most scholars agree, who extended the kingdom northward to the Blackwater Rush, and his son, Munfrid the First, the Mighty, who first crossed that great river, defeating the petty kings of House Darklyn and House Mouton in a series of wars and seizing the prosperous port towns of Duskendale and Maidenpool. Munfrid's son, Durin the Eleventh, the Dim, and his own son, Baron, the Beautiful, yielded up all he had gained and more besides. During the long years when Duwald the First, the Fat, ruled in Storm's End, the masses broke away. Tarth thrice revolted, and even upon Cape Wrath a challenge arose, from a woods witch, known only as the Green Queen, who held the Rainward against Storm's End for the best part of a generation. For a time it was said Dorwall's rule extended no further than the man could urinate off the walls of Storm's End. The tide turned again when Morden II named his base-born half-brother, Runard, as his castellan. A fearsome warrior, Runard became the ruler of the Stormlands in all but name, and took King Morden's sister to wife. Within 5 years, it claimed the kingship as well. It was Morden's own queen who placed Morden's crown on Runard's head. If the songs be true, she shared his bed as well. Morden himself, deemed harmless, was confined to a cell in the tower. His usurper ruled for nigh unto 30 years, as Runard the Bastard, smashing rebel bannermen and petty kings alike in battle after battle. Never a man to confine himself to a single woman, he claimed a daughter from every foe who bent the knee. By the time he died, he had supposedly fathered 99 sons. Most were bastard-born, though Runard had 23 wives, as songs say, and did not share in their father's inheritance, but had to make their own way in the world. For this reason, thousands of years later, many and more of the small folk of the Stormlands, even the meanest and the humblest amongst them, still boast of royal blood. Andals in the Stormlands. Eric the 7th, Durandon, was king in the Stormlands when the Andal longships first began to cross the narrow sea. History remembers him as Eric the Unready, for he took little note of these invaders, famously declaring that he had no interest in the quarrels of strangers in a land far away. The Storm King was embroiled in his own wars at the time, attempting to reconquer Massey's Hook from its infamous pirate king, Justin Milkeye, whilst fending off the incursions of the Dornish king, Oliver Aaronwood. Nor did Eric live to see the result of his inaction, for the Andals remain occupied with their conquest of the Vale for the rest of his lifetime. His grandson, King Carlton II, Durandon, was the first to face the Andals in battle. After 4 generations of war, that monarch, who styled himself Carlton the Conqueror, finally completed the reconquest of Massey's Hook, taking Stone Dance after a year's siege and slaying the last king of House Massey, Joshua, called Softspear. The Storm King held his conquest for less than 2 years. An Andal warlord named Togarian Bar Emon, called Togarian the Terrible, had established his own small kingdom north of the Blackwater, but was being hard-pressed by the Darkland King of Duskendale. Sensing weakness to the south, Togarian took to wife the daughter of Joshua, Softspear, and crossed Blackwater Bay with all his power to establish a new kingdom on Massey's Hook. He built his own castle at Sharp Point. At the Hook's End, whilst driving the Stormlanders from Stone Dance and setting his wife's brother to rule there as a puppet dancing to his strings. Carlton the Conqueror soon had more serious woes to concern him than the loss of Massey's Hook. The eyes of the Andals had turned south, and longships had begun to come ashore all up and down his coasts, full of hungry men with the 7-pointed stars painted on their shields and chests and brows, all of them bent on carving out kingdoms of their own. The rest of his reign, and that of his son and grandson, Carlton III and Munfrid V after him, were times of almost constant war. Though the Storm Kings won 6 major battles, the greatest of these being the Battle of Bronzegate, where Munfrid V Durandon defeated the Holy Brotherhood of the Andals, an alliance of 7 petty kings and warlords at the cost of his own life, the longships kept coming. It was said that for every Andal who fell in battle, 5 more came wading ashore. Tarth was the first of the Stormlands to be overwhelmed. Estamont soon followed. The Andals established themselves on Cape Wrath as well, and might well have taken all the Rainwood if they had not proved as willing to make war on one another as upon the kingdoms of the first men. But King Baldric, the first Durandon, the Cunning, proved expert at setting them one against the other. And King Durin the 21st took the unprecedented step of seeking out the remaining children of the forest in the caves and hollow hills where they had taken refuge, and making common cause with them against the men from beyond the sea. In the battles fought at Black Bog, in the Misty Wood, and beneath the Harling Hill, the precise location of which has sadly been lost, This Weirwood alliance dealt the Andals a series of stinging defeats and checked the decline of the Storm Kings for a time. An even more unlikely alliance between King Cleodon I and three Dornish kings won an even more telling victory over Drux the Corksmaker on the River Slane near Stonehelm a generation later. Yet it is an error to assert that the Storm Kings turned back the invaders. For all their victories, they never stemmed the Andal tide, though many an Andal king and warlord ended with his head impaled upon a spike above the gates of Storm's End. Still, the Andals kept coming. The reverse is also true. The Andals never truly conquered the line of Durindon. Seven times they laid siege to Storm's End, or sought to storm its mighty walls, history tells us. Seven times they failed. The seventh failure was seen as a sign from the gods. After that, no further assaults were made. In the end, two sides simply came together. King Maldon the Fourth took an Andal maiden as his wife, as did his son Durin the 24th, Durin Halfblood. Andal war chiefs became lords and petty kings, wed the daughters of storm lords, and gave them their own daughters in return, did fealty for their lands, and swore their swords to the storm kings. Led by King Ormond III and his queen, the Stormlanders put aside their old gods and took up the gods of the Andals, the faith of the Seven. As the centuries passed, the two races of men became as one, and the children of the forest, all but forgotten, vanished entirely from the Rainwood and the Stormlands. Haas Durindon reached its greatest heights in the epoch that followed. During the age of the Hundred Kingdoms, King Arlan I, the Avenger, swept all before him, extending the borders of his kingdom as far as the Blackwater Rush and the headwaters of the Mandal. His great-grandson, King Arlan III, crossed both the Blackwater and the Trident, and claimed the riverlands in their entirety, at one point planting his crown stag banner on the shores of the Sunset Sea. With the death of Arlan III, however, an inevitable decline began, for the Stormlanders were stretched too thin to hold this vast kingdom together. Rebellion followed rebellion, petty kings sprang up like weeds, castles and keeps fell away. And then the Ironborn came, led by Harwin Hardhand, king of the Iron Islands, and it all befell as previously related. Even as the Stormlanders reeled back before the Iron Men in the north, the Dornish came swarming over the Boneway to press them in the south, and the kings of the Reach sent their knights forth from Highgarden to reclaim all that had been lost in the west. The kingdom of the storm shrank, king by king, battle by battle, year by year. The fall was halted briefly when a fierce warrior prince, Argilac, called the Arrogant, donned the stag's crown. But even a man as mighty as he could only stay the tide, not turn it back. Last of the storm kings, last of the Durindon, Argilac did just that for a time. But near the end of his life, when he had grown old, King Argilac made a clumsy attempt to use House Targaryen of Dragonstone as a shield against the growing might of the Iron Men and their king, Harren the Black. "Never grasp a dragon by the tail," the old proverb says. Argilac the Arrogant did just that, and succeeded only in turning the eyes of Aegon Targaryen and his sisters westward. When they came ashore at the mouth of the Blackwater Rush to begin their conquest of the Seven Kingdoms, with them came a black-eyed, black-haired bastard named Orys Baratheon. House Baratheon. House Baratheon was born amidst the rain and mud of the battle known to history as the Last Storm, when Orys Baratheon thrice turned back the charge of the Knights of Storm's End and slew their king Argilac the Arrogant in single combat. Storm's End, long thought to be impregnable, yielded to Orys without a battle, wisely given the fate of Harrenhal. Afterwards, Orys took King Argilac's daughter to wife, and adopted the Durendon arms and words as his own to honour Argilac's valour. The favour that Aegon the Conqueror showered upon Oris Baratheon made many credit the rumours that he was Aegon's bastard half-brother, though never proved that tale is widely believed to this very day. Others suggest that Horace rose so high because of his prowess at arms and his fierce loyalty to House Targaryen. Even before the conquest, he served as Aegon's champion and sworn shield, and his defeat of King Argilac only added further luster to his name. When King Aegon granted Storm's End to House Baratheon in perpetuity, and named Oris Lord Paramount of the Stormlands and the Hand of the King, none dared suggest that he was unworthy of these honours. During Aegon's invasion of Dorne in 4 AC, however, Lord Oris was taken captive whilst attempting to bring his forces through the Bone Way. His captor was the Will of Will, known as the Widow Lover, who struck off Oris's sword hand. Afterward, all accounts say that Lord Oris became crabbed and bitter. Resigning his office as King's Hand, he turned his attention to Dorne, obsessed with the idea of revenge. His chance came during the reign of King Aenys I, when he shattered part of the Vulture King's host, and Lord Walter Will, the Widow Lover's son, fell into his hands.
From the History of Archmaester Gildane. Oris Baratheon, known now as Oris Onehand, rode forth from Storm's End one last time to smash the Dornish beneath the walls of Stonehelm. When Walter Will was delivered into his hand, wounded but alive, Lord Oris said, "Your father took my hand, I claim yours as repayment." So saying, he hacked off Lord Walter's sword hand. Then he took his other hand, and both his feet as well, calling them his usury. Strange to say, Lord Baratheon died on the march back to Storm's End, of the wounds he himself had taken during the battle. But his son Davos always said he died content, smiling at the rotting hands and feet that dangled in his tent like a string of onions.
The Baratheons remained closely connected to House Targaryen and played a significant role in the troubled reigns of Aegon the Conqueror's successors. Lord Oris Baratheon's grandson, Lord Robar, was the first great lord to openly proclaim for Prince Jaehaerys against his uncle, Maegor the Cruel. For his loyalty and courage, he was named Protector of the Realm and Hand of the King, following Maegor's strange death upon the Iron Throne. During the remainder of King Jaehaerys' minority, Lord Robar shared the rule of the realm with the king's mother, the Dowager Queen Alysa. Half a year later, the two wed. From their union sprang the Lady Jocelyn, who married the eldest of the old king's sons and became mother to the Princess Rhaenys, the queen who never was, as the glib jester Mushroom called her, and Bormund Baratheon, who succeeded his father as Lord of Storm's End. At the Great Council of 101 AC, convened by King Jaehaerys I to debate the matter of succession, Lord Bormund was outspoken in supporting the claim of his niece, Princess Rhaenys, and her son, Prince Laenor of House Velaryon, but found himself on the losing side of the argument. The power of Storm's End and its close proximity to King's Landing and the Iron Throne made the Baratheons the first of the great houses of Westeros, whose support was sought by Princess Rhaenyra and King Aegon II after the death of their father, King Viserys I Targaryen. By that time, however, Lord Bormund had passed, and it was his son Boris who ruled, and Boris was a different kind of man entirely. Where Lord Bormund had been staunch in support of Rhaenyra's late husband Laenor, Lord Boris scented opportunity and proved reticent when courted by Lucerys Velaryon, Rhaenyra's second son by Prince Laenor. When Lysiris flew his dragon to Storm's End, seeking support, he found that his cousin, Prince Aemon Targaryen, had arrived before him, and was busily arranging his marriage to one of Boris's daughters. Lord Boris was infuriated at the message Lysiris carried, wherein Princess Rhaenyra betrayed an unseemly arrogance in assuming Storm's End would support her cause, and by Prince Lysiris' refusal to take one of his lordship's daughters for his bride. The prince was betrothed to another. He angrily ejected the young Valyrian from his hall, and did nothing to prevent Prince Aemon from following him to take revenge for the eye he had lost to Lysiris years earlier, so long as said revenge was not enacted within the walls of Storm's End. Prince Lysiris tried to flee on his young dragon, Arrax, but Aemon pursued him upon his great dragon, Vhagar. Had a storm not been howling through Shipbreaker Bay, Lysiris might have escaped, but it was not to be. The boy and his dragon both died, tumbling into the sea within sight of Storm's End, as Vhagar roared triumphantly. It was the first royal bloodshed in the Dance of the Dragons, though much more was to follow. In the early part of the war, Lord Boris proved reluctant to face the dragons personally. But towards the end of the dance, he and his Stormlander seized King's Landing during the Moon of the Three Kings, restoring the city to order and winning promises that his eldest daughter would become the new queen of the widowed King Aegon II. Then he boldly led the last of the royalist hosts against the approaching Riverlanders, who were commanded by the young Lord Kermit Tully. The even younger Benjicot Blackwood and Blackwood's sister Alisan. When the Lord of Storm's End learned that the host was led by boys and women, he grew confident in his victory. But bloody Ben Blackwood, as he was remembered after, broke his flank, while Black Alley Blackwood led the archers who brought down his knights. Lord Boris was defiant to the end, and the accounts claim he killed a dozen knights and slew Lords Derry and Malastor before he himself was slain by Kermit Tully. With his death and the defeat of his Stormlanders, the Dance of the Dragons was all but over. House Baratheon had gambled greatly in supporting King Aegon II, and it was a choice that brought them nothing but ill during the reign of King Aegon III, the Dragonbane, and the regency preceding it. As the years passed, and king followed king upon the Iron Throne, these old rifts were forgotten, and the Baratheons came to serve the crown faithfully once more, until the Targaryens themselves put that loyalty to the test. This occurred during the reign of King Aegon the Fifth Targaryen, known to history as Aegon the Unlikely, when the Lord of Storm's End was Lionel Baratheon, a swaggering giant of a man known as the Laughing Storm, one of the greatest fighters of his day. Lord Lionel had always been amongst King Aegon's most leal supporters. So firm was their friendship that his grace gladly agreed to betroth his elder son and heir to Lord Lionel's daughter. All was well until Prince Duncan met and became smitten with the mysterious woman known only as Jenny of Oldstones, a witch, some say, and took her for his wife, in defiance of his father the king.
Of Lord Boros, Septon Eustace writes, Lord Boromond was stone, hard and strong and unmoving. Lord Boros was the wind, which rages and howls and blows this way and that.
The love between Jenny of Oldstones, with flowers in her hair, and Duncan, Prince of Dragonflies, is beloved of singers, storytellers, and young maids even to this day. But it caused great grief to Lord Lionel's daughter and brought shame and dishonour to House Baratheon. So great was the wrath of the Laughing Storm that he swore a bloody oath of vengeance, renounced allegiance to the Iron Throne, and had himself crowned as a new Storm King. Peace was restored only after the Kingsguard knight, Sir Duncan, the Tall, face Lord Lionel in a trial by battle. Prince Duncan renounced his claim to crown and throne, and King Aegon V agreed that his youngest daughter, the Princess Rhaelle, would wed Lord Lionel's heir. As the Seven in their wisdom would have it, it was the match that King Aegon V agreed to in order to appease the Laughing Storm that ultimately led to the end of Targaryen rule in the Seven Kingdoms. In 245 AC, Princess Rhaelle fulfilled her father's promise and wed Ormond Baratheon, young lord of Storm's End. The following year she gave him a son, Stefan, who served as a page and a squire at King's Landing, and became a close companion of Prince Aerys, eldest son of King Jaehaerys II, and heir to the Iron Throne. Sadly, Lord Stefan drowned in Shipbreaker Bay whilst returning from a mission to Volantis, where King Aerys II had sent him to seek a wife for his son Rhaegar. But Stefan's own firstborn son, Robert, succeeded him as Lord of Storm's End and grew to be one of the finest knights in the Seven Kingdoms. A warrior so strong and fearless that many hailed him as the Laughing Storm reborn. When the madness of King Aerys II became too much to be borne, it was to Lord Robert that the lords of the realm turned. In 282 AC, at the ford of the Trident, Robert Baratheon slew Rhaegar Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone, and shattered his host, effectively ending 3 centuries of rule by the House of the Dragon. Soon thereafter he ascended the Iron Throne himself as Robert I Baratheon, the progenitor of a glorious new dynasty.
Many other Baratheons have won renown over the centuries, following in the footsteps of Orys Onehand and the Storm Kings before him. Sir Raymond Baratheon, a younger son of Lord Baratheon, served in the King's Guard when Aenys I was forced to war against the Faith, and saved the life of his king when the poor fellows attempted to murder him in his bed. Knights such as the Stormbreaker and the Laughing Storm brought glory onto the house, whilst Lord Ormond Baratheon fought and died beneath the Targaryen banner on the stepstones during the War of the Ninepenny Kings.
The Men of the Stormlands. As King Robert proved upon the Trident, and as the lords and kings before him showed likewise, the men of the Stormlands are as hardy and fierce and skilled in war as any in the Seven Kingdoms. The longbows of the marchers are especially famed, and many of the most famous bowmen of song and history are said to hail from the Dornish marchers. Fletcher Dick, the notorious outlaw of the Kingswood Brotherhood, was born in a village near the Marcher Castle of Stonehelm, and is held by many to be the finest archer who ever drew bow. The Stormlands have also produced their share of great seamen and sailors. Storm's End itself, looming over the great cliffs of Doran's Point, and the treacherous rocks of Shipbreaker Bay, offers no safe anchorage for either warship or merchant craft. But in the time of the Storm Kings, war fleets were oft-maintained on Massey's Hook, Estamont, and in the towns and fishing villages along the Sea of Dawn. Later, other monarchs preferred to dock their fleets on the western shore of Tarth, where that great island's mountains helped to shelter them from the storms that often rage through the narrow sea. The Sapphire Isle, as some call it, is ruled by House Tarth of Evenfall Hall, an old family of Andal descent that boasts of ties to the Durrandons, the Baratheons, and more recently to House Targaryen. Once kings in their own right, the Lords of Tarth still style themselves the Evenstar, a title that they claim goes back unto the dawn of days.
Many of the folk of Tarth, highborn and low alike, claim descent from a legendary hero, Sir Galadon of Morn, who was said to wield a sword called the Just Made, given to him by the Seven themselves. Given the role that the Just Made plays in Sir Galadon's tale, Maester Hubert, in his Kin of the Stag, has suggested that Galadon of Morn was no rude warrior of the Age of Heroes turned into a knight by singers 1,000 years later, but an actual historic figure of more recent times. Hubert also notes that Morn was a royal seat of petty kings on the eastern coast of Tarth until the Storm Kings made them submit, but that its ruins indicate that the site was made by Andals, not First Men.
The fiercest fighters in the Stormlands, and perhaps in all of Westeros, are undoubtedly the men of the Marches, who are said to be born with sword in hand and off boast of learning to fight even before they learn to walk. Theirs is the task of protecting the realm of the Storm Kings from the ancient enemies to the west, and especially the south. The castles of the Dornish Marches are amongst the strongest of the realm, and for good reason, for seldom has a generation passed where they have not faced some new attack. They were established to create a bulwark against incursions from the Dornish and the kings of the Reach. The Marcher Lords are duly proud of their history as key defenders of the realm of the Storm Kings, and many are the ballads and tales of their valor. Among the sternest of the Marcher seats are Sternhelm, the ancient seat of House Swan, with its watchtowers of black and white stone, which stands above the waters of the River Slane, with its rapids, pools, and waterfalls. Blackhaven, home to House Dondarrion, with its forbidding black basalt walls and bottomless dry moat, and Night Song of the Singing Towers, where House Carron has held sway for many centuries. Though styled as Lords of the Marches, the Carrons hold no dominion over the other Marcher Lords. They count themselves the oldest of the Marcher houses, however, acclaim the Swan's dispute, and have always been prominent in leading the defense of the Stormlands. As the Marchers are famed for their strong castles and their ballads, the Rainwood is known for its rain, its silences, and a wealth in fir and wood and amber. Here the trees rule, it is said, and the castles often seem as if they have grown from the earth instead of being built. But the knights and lords of the Rainwood have roots as deep as the trees that shelter them, and have oft proved themselves steadfast in battle, strong and stubborn, and immovable.
Famous for their warriors and singers alike, House Carron has a storied history that stretches back to the Age of Heroes. The Carrons are wont to say that the nightingales of their house have been seen on 1,000 battlefields, and the histories show that Night Song has been besieged no less than 37 times in the last 1,000 years.
Storm's End. The history of the building of Storm's End is known to us only through songs and stories. The tales of Durin Godsgreave and Fair Elenai, daughter of two gods. Supposedly it was the 7th of the castles that Durin raised in that spot, though that number may well be a later interpolation of the faith. Maesters who have served at the castle testify to its vast strength and ingenious construction. Whether designed by Brandon the Builder or not, its great curtain wall, with its stones so cunningly fitted that the wind cannot get a grip on them, is justly famed. So too is the great central keep that thrusts up into the sky to overlook Shipbreaker Bay.
Storm's End is surely an old castle, but when compared to the ruined ring forts of the First Men, or even the First Keep of Winterfell, which a past maester in service to the Starks examined and found to have been rebuilt so many times that a precise dating could not be made, the great tower and perfectly joined stones of the Storm's End curtain wall seem much beyond what the First Men were capable of for many thousands of years. The great effort involved in raising the wall was one thing, but that was more a brute effort than the high art needed to make a wall where even the wind cannot find purchase. Archmaester Viron, in his Triumphs and Defeats,